Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're back with RCR, Reality Check Radio's Greenwashed program with Don and Jaspreet. And today's guest is someone who was born in Northern England. She arrived in New Zealand at the age of 8, raised in Whangarei, gained a BSc in mathematics from the University of Auckland, and then a PhD in mathematics education from Rutgers University in the United States. Then, after working in the education sector for 20 years, entered the business world with Michael Hill International. And then after that became a founding member of the ACT Party from 1996 to 2005. And I speak of Dr. Muriel Newman. Welcome to our show, Muriel. Great to have you on. You've written prolifically for now 20 years, especially in under the moniker of the New Zealand Centre for Political Research. And before that, there was another name. It's just slipped my mind. But you know, how do you do that? I mean, it's a massive task you've undertaken. You've had some great articles. I said to Jaspreet before we came on air, I said, if the prescription for New Zealand could be written, it's all in Dr. Muriel Newman's output. But no doubt someone from the conversation like Finlay McDonald would have the counterview. So, great that you've had this output going for so long. Today, we're specifically going to talk about your most recent post called Climate Deception. But yeah, look, maybe you might just want to add into a little bit of at the start of this show, a bit about yourself that tells us what drives you to do this stuff. Welcome.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. It is interesting, you know, because it's the 9 years that I had in Parliament that gave me the information base that you need to be able to write on a variety of topics. And to be honest, when I first left Parliament in 2005, you know, writing a sort of 2,000-word article was pretty easy because, you know, you're up to date with all of the information and you knew where to go to find more detail if you needed it. But I have to say, as the years have gone on, it's not quite so easy, but it's still a challenge. And it's all the driving force really is that the information that determines the policy prescription that governments impose on their populations and on their countries is quite fraught. In other words, there's a lot of complexity in it. And oftentimes, depending on the flavour of the government, it can have detrimental impacts on the community and on the country in the longer term, or beneficial ones. And the trick with policy is to be able to understand what the driving forces are and whether it is going to be good or bad. And then, of course, if it's going to be good, you support it. And if it's going to be a bad outcome, then you oppose it. So it's getting that sort of information out there into the public arena that is the challenge, because it is so complicated that most people don't even know where to start. And I was lucky, as I said, to have had, you know, 9 years in Parliament where you learn where to go for that sort of policy detail. So, yes, it's an ongoing challenge, but it's a wonderful one, I have to say.
And so taking it to simple terms for me, I'm big on less government, less regulation, less onerous oversight by the state. Yet we seem to have allowed more and more, under the free market philosophies of the 1980s, we seem to have allowed over time more and more overbearing governance in our systems. I mean, why did we do that? Have the bureaucrats or have other forces sort of infiltrated to the point where we just don't control our own destiny the way we would, those of us that are in the free market and want the freedom movements would like to have? It seems very overbearing, Muriel, if I might say. How do you see it?
Look, I think you're exactly right. I think that there has been a huge encroachment on individual freedom, and, you know, you just look back at some areas, like even humour. You know, you go back to the days of Billy T. James and, you know, Monty Python's Flying Circus and all those things where anything goes, you know. And nowadays, it's so controlled. If anyone says anything that's, you know, slightly edgy, I mean, you know, you can be flipping, well, almost put in jail. And so somehow we've allowed it to happen. And I think it's a combination, to be honest, of politicians who cave in now to public pressure. And it's not public pressure by the general public. It's public pressure by small, very vocal lobby groups who've got the media on side, and they viciously go after politicians who don't do what they want. And, you know, you can sort of put the blame, if you like, to some extent at this whole identity politics movement, I think, this sort of left-wing attempt to, you know, enforce various agendas all based on someone's identity and not on the public good. The public good has almost become a bad term nowadays. And so when you combine that sort of extremism with the risk-averse nature of politicians and governments, you know, it's a pretty toxic mix that ends up by sort of restricting virtually everything we do.
Yeah, and I wonder, Muriel, whether somewhere the blame also lies on the average Kiwi, because I migrated there 15 years ago, and I've been amazed at how many times I don't get a reaction out of people, out of sometimes things which are right in their faces. We are just too laid back as a country. Or am I being too harsh there?
No, I think you are right. And, you know, to some extent, that's probably the education system can bear some responsibility, because, you know, children in New Zealand, they are indoctrinated, but they're indoctrinated with ideologies, you know, of the usually it's of the unions. And so they don't learn to be as, what's the expression, just up to date with political movements and political expression. I spent 3 years teaching during those years when I was a teacher. I spent 3 years in New York at the United Nations International School, and it was quite a culture shock, if you like, going there and seeing how politically engaged and active children were. And this is, you know, from senior students at high school right through to littlies at the primary school. And they were really, really well informed about all sorts of things. And then you came back to New Zealand, and like you say, children here weren't informed at all. And of course, if you're not informed as a child on a whole big area of life, then when you become an adult and get really busy with jobs and families and all those things, oftentimes you don't quite get up to speed either. So, you know, I think that is a major problem, as well as the fact, to be honest, we've got that other thing going here, where if you do speak out and you happen to say the wrong thing, you know, depending on what debate you're talking about, I mean, you can be vilified and all the rest of it. And if you speak out at work, you can be threatened with losing your job. So it's a very risky business getting involved in all that. And I think most people just, you know, want to play it safe.
Yes, yeah, they do want to.
And, you know, there's plenty of public policemen now, isn't there, for, you know, watching your every move. It seems to be par for the course to have almost people willing to dob you in if you just stray a little bit. So we've got all these faux policemen effectively watching our every movement, especially in mainstream media. They, if you had poked your nose up on the wrong side of the ledger to their ideas, you got crucified. There's many politicians, you will perhaps know of many, Muriel, that have basically had career-ending stuff happen to them because of the toxicity of the mainstream media, who just go after them on minor points until they just have to give in. It's a sad indictment on ourselves, actually. In fact, I agree with you also. My nieces are Americans, and they certainly have a whole lot more patriotism in their veins than than a lot of New Zealanders do. So, yeah, interesting times. Anyway, let's move on to your latest missive, the climate deception, you've called it, and you've opened it by saying that there's two reports released by the coalition government this or recently. One is a strategy paper strategy paper from Simon Court, the minister, and the other one is around an emissions reduction future or planning here in New Zealand. Now, when you read the strategy document, it's pretty basic. I mean, it's only two or three pages. Most New Zealanders reading that will just say, oh, well, so what? There's five pillars. They all look pretty innocuous. Nothing much to see there, but it's coming at great cost, isn't it? I see last year the figure was we spent over $1.1 billion on net zero initiatives last year alone. For what? But we have these five pillars. Infrastructure is resilient, communities are well prepared, credible market support, the climate transition, clean energy is abundant and affordable, world-leading climate innovation boosts the economy, and nature-based solutions address climate change. Well, you know, if you were a citizen just reading that, you'd say, oh, that's all too hard. Nothing to see here. We'll just move on. But there's plenty to see in there, isn't there, Muriel? Plenty to see.
Yes, I think that, that's the trouble. When you publish reports that are at that sort of motherhood and apple pie level, then, you know, no one sort of sees the sinister side of it. And the sinister side of it is what you just said, which is, you know, over $1 billion spent on initiatives that really will lead nowhere for no good. No, not, you know, in terms of benefiting the country or the people, except it's benefiting certain agendas. But that $1 billion could do an awful lot if it was put into, you know, improving resilience of communities, rebuilding those damn bridges and roads that were wiped out by Cyclone Gabriel that are still not repaired. You know, and doing stuff that actually will mean that in times of bad flooding or huge seas or whatever, that homes and communities can actually stay safe. So it's money that is being, in my mind, wasted on an ideology that is stupid anyway, to be quite honest. And that was the point that I was trying to make in the article, that, you know, this whole climate change agenda is based on it's like a house of cards. And at some time in the future, my fervent hope is that the public will wake up to the fact that they've been totally misled, and they'll say, enough is enough, and the whole flipping thing will come crashing down. I think it's appalling what's happening in this agenda.
It is it's my fervent wish too, Muriel. And in fact, just another little snippet that I gleaned yesterday from the media was that the 600,000 hectares of post-1989 emissions trading scheme forestry registered. I didn't know this, but each hectare had a charge until this coalition government disbanded it recently of $30 a hectare per year. So that is $18 million given to the bureaucrats to manage those 600,000 hectares carbon accounting systems. I mean, talk about writing your own check for a nonsense concept. I was staggered when I read it. I'm pleased I'm not part of it. I used to have forestry. I'm now out of it. I took my forestry little block out of it. Never entered it. And I'm so pleased I don't have to play in that muddy, that dirty, dirty paddock called bureaucracy around emissions trading. So anyway, your article goes on to talk about, and I agree, by the way, the money that we've just talked about would be better spent on local infrastructure, making stuff better, adapting to what we've got. But it seems that we need a whole lot more people in the way to hinder that. Anyway, that's my rant for the moment. You've sort of talked about the democratic process in this article too, and you sort of are implying, in fact, you even write it, that perhaps this one part of this coalition government is basically Labor light. And I imagine for someone like yourself, that's quite disappointing. As it's been said by Jasper, even I, we are quite disappointed by the centre of this coalition, or the centre left, you might say. What do you make of that? Why did you write that? Are you sensing it's not just knitting together that well in the coalition at the moment, this stuff?
I think that, you know, it's the fact that there are a large number of people who think that, you know, this ideological drive for net zero by 2050, number one, is silly, and number two, is going to be hugely damaging to the economy. And yet there is no one in Parliament representing that view. And that really annoys me. If you look back, Maureen Pugh, do you remember all the fuss over when she said after Cyclone Gabriel, and the minister at the time, James Shaw, alluded to the fact that humans were the cause of the cyclone. And she said, simply, you know, show me the evidence, minister, you know, that humans have caused Cyclone Gabriel. And of course he couldn't. But what happened before he had a chance to sort of, you know, disgrace himself, so to speak, in the public eye? The national leader sort of jumped in and essentially made her apologise and mea culpa and all that sort of thing. And we just found that was so stupid, you know, that the national, the right side of politics is so imbued into this whole flipping climate ideology that common sense has just gone out the window. And we're also concerned that you know, both New Zealand First and ACT are aligning themselves with the zero carbon agenda instead of representing those Kiwis who think that it's all gone too far.
I agree, and I did find it quite awkward to watch when even ACT's Mark Cameron was sort of chided in his first term for appearing to be someone who was anti the policy, and he was sort of silenced for a bit. But I'm heartened to say he's back with a vengeance in this parliament. So, look, let's hope there is enough of their caucuses in each of the three in the coalitions to sway their leadership, because I think that's our only hope, is the leadership has to realize that their underlings are stirred up and they do want this to be remedied. Would you agree with that?
Well, look, I think just to jump in there, I think that the reality of politics is that political parties will swing if there is a public move towards something. And so even if they've got a pretty entrenched position, they can be made to change their mind if the public shows that actually now, you know, they're out of place, they're on the wrong side of the fence. And so what this means is that we need more Kiwis to be writing into politicians and you know, buttonholing them in the street or whenever you get an opportunity and saying to them that, you know, this ideological drive is costing this country far too much, that they've gone too far in it and they should, you know, button back on it and take a more moderate line, a more sensible line. And instead of $1 billion into stupid projects, you know, put it into things that, as you said, will help our communities. And so it really does fall back on the public to help change the mind of the politicians. And if everybody did that, you know, like on our website, one of the things we have on the nzcpr.com is we've got a list of all the email addresses of all the MPs, and we've tried to make it really easy for people to be able to send a message to MPs and the various parties. And when we run campaigns, we will often ask people to do that, you know, to send a message to the National Party or whoever it is, to say to them, you know, you're on the wrong side of this argument. And we would suggest, I would personally suggest to anybody concerned about any issue, don't forget the power of communication and that you have a right to have your say. They're your representatives in Parliament. They are representing the people of New Zealand, and we have the right to tell them what we think about some of the stuff they're doing that we think might be wrong. And so if there was enough of a groundswell of people opposing these agendas, then all of a sudden you would find that their commitment to more extreme ideas would start to, fall down. They would start to become more moderate. And that's probably the first step towards the sort of outcome that we all want.
Yes, and this is what we call as moving of the Overton window, or the window of discourse. And we saw this during COVID, Muriel, when suddenly you were not allowed to talk about anything. You were banned from Facebook. You were banned from something, any other discussion that you might be having. And suddenly the politicians do want to talk about that. But of course, the bureaucrats are still hanging on to the old thing, like even this year, we need to get boosters and so on. But bringing this back to climate change, I think nowhere is this nonsense better exemplified than by the fact that current Prime Minister Christopher Luxon was at the helm of affairs of Air New Zealand when it jumped on the net zero by 2050 bandwagon. There was him talking that time as the CEO of Air New Zealand about how well it's doing on its sustainability tracking. And yet this week, there's barely a whimper in New Zealand media when Air New Zealand has become the first major airline in the world to ditch the 2050 targets for net zero. Of course, Air New Zealand says it's going to replace them by something short-term, something more achievable. But the long and short of it was they found that the technologies were not available, and moreover, it was going to be too expensive to do that. Yet, somehow, central government, local government, councils, territorial authorities seem to think it's all right to keep piling on costs on the average ratepayer, taxpayer for this nonsense. That is not abating at all.
But I think, you might find that Air New Zealand's move is the beginning, because oftentimes what you need is somebody to take a lead. You might want to do it yourselves, but you're a little bit afraid. And once someone else has done it, you think, oh, well, look, they got away with it, so can we. And so, when I read what they were planning to do, I thought, well, that is a good step. That's a first step. And probably what you might find is that other airlines follow around the world. And so it starts to have a sort of a top-down effect, not just here, but everywhere. And maybe this actually is the beginning of return to more common sense. You just can't tell, to be honest. But you are right, though, that some of the changes that, have gone on in central and local government level are just way over the top, and they're costing people huge amounts, but just no one realises it. It's like, I was looking at the effect of some of the sea level rise stuff that councils are now putting into their 10-year plans, and the fact that, the insurance premiums are being pushed up in areas that they've identified as, potentially going to be inundated with the sea, because, they're planning for a 1 metre plus rise over 100 years, whereas at the moment, if you look back at our history, I think it's going to be, 120 millimetres over 100 years is the actual rate of sea level, whereas, councils are putting into their plans it's going to be over a metre. And you think to yourself, what matters? Because now the insurance companies are increasing their risk premiums and people can't afford to pay their insurance costs. And that's driving up inflation. And so
yes,
we keep interest rates higher for longer. So every New Zealander actually suffers. And it's just terrible. It's what I said earlier about the complexities of public policy. And if you get the wrong assumptions at some points in it, it can have a profound impact. But because people aren't aware of it, they don't realise that it's this stupid climate agenda that's causing it all. And that's where the finger pointing should go. And that's what the politicians need to change.
100%. The sort of modeling, sea level rise modeling. There's also floodplain modeling. And recently, Dawn and I had spoken to a councillor from the Selwyn District Council who was talking about the fact that the huts around Lake Ellesmere there, they are using everything to get those vacated. So be it sea level rise modeling, be it Nahita who's saying that it is areas of cultural significance, or suddenly that the fact that people have been there too long and now they no longer meet with the legislation, the compliance required with the three waters norms that have come through with the new regulator. More recently, I read about the Christchurch, ex-mayor of Christchurch, Leanne Denzel, talking about the fact, and I will quote, she says that one of the features of a recent report, this was on the Hawke's Bay flooding, she said, that stood out for me was that some rivers had experienced a 1-in-1,000-year return period event, and this overwhelmed stock banks that had been built for a 1-in-100-year flooding event. So what are these people suggesting, actually, that we actually build to 1-in-1,000-year those level of stock banks? This is outrageous. And the costs this has, this sort of, you know, fairy tale, imaginative scenarios, their real life ramifications are disastrous.
That's exactly right. And, you know, going back to that sea level thing, you know, the meter rise, if you look at the rate of increase of the sea level, you know, over the last recent history, the rate of increase, it would take 800 years to get to a meter.
Yes.
And you think to yourself, why on earth would councils be requiring infrastructure to be, you know, cope with a meter rise or any sort of planning to cope with a meter rise? It's just stupid. And like you say, to try and suggest that councils, you know, build infrastructure for a 1-in-1,000-year event. I mean, you know, how mad is that? What you've got to do, though, you do have to make sure you've got good plans in place so that if something extraordinary happens, then you do have a plan so that people can keep safe. You know, I think we would all agree with that. Like if all of a sudden there was a huge tsunami came and hit the coast of New Zealand, mind you, normally you don't get enough warning, but, you know, if you did get enough warning, then you would want to send everybody up to the nearest big hill that they could find. So you've got to, you know, you've got to be sensible. But you certainly don't try and build a blinking seawall to try and keep out a tsunami, you know, because that would be just absolutely stupid and everyone would see that. So a lot of this other stuff gets done or gets agreed to because people aren't quite aware of what's going on and they don't realise how silly the project really is. And that's part of our problem, I think, in New Zealand.
So in your article, you do allude to Gregory Wrightstone from the Brown, where's he from? I've just lost my train of thought for a moment. Anyway, a well-known person.
He was a reviewer for the IPCC.
Yeah, a reviewer for the IPCC. Yeah. Anyway, what is clear to me, Muriel, and you put it in your article here, is that so many of the models effectively that councils around New Zealand and governments are using are basically drawn up by, as one of our previous guests called, charlatans. They almost appear to want to show that they, like your sea level story, it's linear. Everything just goes, you add a bit more CO2 and there will be a direct result of an increased temperature, when in fact it's logarithmic. And a lot of people haven't understood that, especially our climate modelers. They seem to be playing games. None of their scenarios of their outlook to 2100, their high-end scenarios have looked at, that is the 8.5 scenario, the RCP 8.5, has come anything close to being true over the last 30 years. So we've got a problem that we haven't got. Well, so this is how I see it. We've got a new coalition in power. We've got a prime minister who won't out this stuff as being over the top and unacceptable. We've got a deputy prime minister, the same minister of finance. We've got a minister for climate change that's sort of in agreement. We've got a minister for the environment that won't say anything. And we've got a minister for local government that won't say, council, please don't use this stuff. What we do have is we have a sort of more junior person, Simon Court, who is saying that RCP 8.5 should not be used. But and saying what I'm getting at is none of the lead players in this coalition are directing the councils to back off. And that's so disappointing. So disappointing.
Here's the thought, right? Because you know, I'm aware that the farming community must be really upset by a lot of this stuff. Not just that sea level rise stuff, but you know, the methane, the methane problem, you know, where instead of using the correct multiplier of 7 to calculate, you know, the warming effect of methane, they're using 28, which traditionally they have used, but now the UN has admitted that that's wrong. It's too high and it should be 7. And if the government corrected their methane and their climate inventory and used the correct multiplier for methane, the actual climate change problem that New Zealand has would virtually disappear overnight. And we would be quite close to reaching our 2050 target now without having to sacrifice the economy and businesses and everything else. And so this is my thought, given what you were just saying, Don. And that is that, you know, farmers have left it to their lobby groups to put pressure on governments. And that's usually fair enough, to be honest. You know, they do that work, they lobby, they try to get agreements, they try to get the best outcomes when policy is being developed, you know, for their supporters. But, you know, maybe it's time that people, you go back to what I said earlier about politicians responding to individual people who ask them to do something. So, you know, as a member of parliament, if we got a letter from somebody, you know, you had to reply to it, right? You can't just ignore it. They might have changed things now because that was, you know, a lot of years ago that I was there. But it seems to me that if all the farmers who are upset about what's going on individually wrote to the Prime Minister and all those key ministers that you just mentioned and said to them, look, you guys are going too far. You've got to, you know, pull this back. It's ridiculous. And had two or three points, even, you know, you've got to get the multiplier for methane right. You've got to get a realistic level for sea level rise. What you're doing is just ridiculous. And if they started writing to ministers like that, so this is hundreds and thousands of voices, right, that are now, you know, into the face of the politicians, I tell you what, it would make a difference.
Yeah, and
I can remember, sorry, go on.
No, you go on. Didn't mean to interrupt.
I can remember, this is probably maybe 5 or 10 years after I'd been out of parliament, I remember there was some issue on the go and someone was interviewing, it was a national, must have been a member of the government at the time, and they said, yes, we've changed our mind on such and such. And he said, I got so many letters from people telling me, you know, that we had to do this and not that. I can't remember what the issue was. But anyway, it turned out that he'd received 15 letters from people about this particular issue. And it must have been, you know, it obviously wasn't a key issue, if you know what I mean. It was something where it was possible to easily change the direction of whatever it was they were doing. But it was 15 people. And I remember thinking to myself, well, gosh, if hundreds of Kiwis actually wrote into the politicians, not form letters. Form letters, you can't use those because otherwise they take no notice of them. But if they wrote in individually and said, look, you know, this is the fact. Are you aware of what you are doing to my business and my community, you know, by doing X, Y, or Z? And actually put it onto them and ask them to let them know what they thought. Then it will make a difference. I can tell you that now. It may not make a difference on day one, but if enough people keep doing it, I mean, that was the benefit of Groundswell when it started, if you remember. You know, that whole thing of having so many people with their cars and their tractors and their dogs and, you know, everything else all turning up, it had a huge impact at the time, even though the politicians may not have admitted it. It did. And well, that's where grassroots advocacy really matters.
Well, to case in point, 2003, what was known as the Fight Against Ridiculous Taxes concept, it was called FART by the acronym, but it was around the BERTs and P emissions from ruminant animals. As a leader of that, we got, I think, 60,000 signatures on petitions in a matter of weeks, We mobilised the country in a matter of weeks, and we ended up on the steps of Parliament to one of the biggest demonstrations in that era. And within days, that emissions levy was removed. And of course, the behind the bike shed deals were done afterwards that I didn't know about at the time. But as a leader of that, and I know it was sort of made more public by the tractor driving up the steps of Parliament at the time, you know, it just showed you the power that could happen if society and the affected got mobilised. And that was before social media got really active. So, yeah, today it should be a whole lot easier. But as Jaspreet said, we're sort of comfortably numb in New Zealand to this stuff. It's almost like the affected people have become immune to the attacks on their pocketbook, effectively, and their freedoms. Yeah, so
I think everyone needs to wake themselves up. That's the reality. You know, it's like I've been involved in this blinking battle over the foreshore and seabed. You might have read, you know, recently that the minister has now put a time frame on for changing the law. Now, we saw that was going to be a problem when the law was changed. If you remember, the foreshore and seabed used to be owned by the Crown on behalf of all New Zealanders. That was really from the time that New Zealand was first a country. That was British common law, and that had been confirmed by a number of important court cases. And then what happened was that in 2003, a court of appeal said, nah, maybe there's some customary rights in the foreshore and seabed. That led Labor to have to bring in the Foreshore and Seabed Act to reassert Crown ownership. And then National changed the law and said, no, now Maori can claim the coast if they want to. Well, that led to 600 claims flooding in for the whole coast, up in every bit of New Zealanders' claim many times over. And what the courts were doing was that they were being very liberal in their interpretation of the law. And the end result was going to be, if no one did anything, the end result was going to be the whole of New Zealand's coastline would be owned by private tribal groups right out to the edge of the territorial sea. That was starting. We made a fuss. And then now the law change is going to go ahead. Now, that was a fraught process and it took a lot of effort, but the law change is going to go ahead, whether or not it does, you know, actually solve the problem, because the problem is created by activist judges in the courts who look at tikanga and give it all sorts of wonderful meanings that, you know, weren't the original intention of the law. But whether or not it actually results in the right outcome, we don't know. But at least it's a step in the right direction. So it does mean you have to make a fuss. And that's what Kiwis have got to learn. If you don't like what they're doing, make a fuss. Get your neighbours to make a fuss. Get your friends to make a fuss. Everybody join in. And it's like your opposition to the fart tax thing. I mean, that was a wonderful exercise, Don, you know, and well done for taking a lead on that, because you did change the law that was going to be. And, you know, you all need, everyone needs to take credit. We were out there marching on that as well. And so that's what New Zealanders have got to remember. You've got to shake off this oblivion that we're all, you know, sort of living in. And we've got to realise it's up to us. We can damn well stop this stuff if we try hard enough, and we haven't been trying hard enough.
No, I agree. We haven't been. It comes back to the same thing for me about absolving personal responsibility. But also this difference that I see in the demographic in New Zealand as compared to the homeland, India, is that a lot of people are employed by the state, between bureaucrats, teachers, and a whole lot of, you know, the social security network. India doesn't have that. A whole lot of this, there is a massive amount of people who are dependent on the state, and you don't want to rattle your own cage. That is a thing I've seen. But you were talking about the Foreshore and Seabed Act. I came in around 2009, and I remember reading about that, but we got into farming straight away. Wasn't that engaged. But now looking back to me, it was like the whole UNDRIP of the United Nations Rights Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We took a lead in that. around the year we came, 2009 was when Peter Schopels was sent to New York to sign that by the National Party. And here we are, 15 years later, the chickens are coming home to roost. And you captured a bit of the globalist agendas at play in your 2020 article in the Star News that runs on the Otago Daily Times. This article was called New Zealand's Path to the United Nations Agenda 2030. And I could be mistaken, Muriel, but I think 4 years from the time you printed this article, I doubt this would make it to print again. But you very neatly laid out in this one how Jacinda had gone to the UN, United Nations Goalkeepers Conference, how we pretty much everything in our lives is being dictated by what the United Nations hands down as dictates to our governments. Because as I see it, our governments are surely, they're not listening to the people. So who are they listening to? These overseas interests. And be it the fact that Labour has left, we still see, we saw Luxon going over and meeting, you know, Larry Fink from BlackRock and talking about foreign investment for all of these nice sounding things. And one can't help but think, what is going to change? What is going to make these people actually see the light and stop this, stop selling us out as a country?
It is a real worry, all that stuff, because, you know, it's very difficult from the ground to tell what the actual driving forces and agendas are. And that was one thing about Jacinda Ardern making that speech that you referred to in New York. She did actually explain to us, you know, those of us who actually watched the video, that what she was doing, and we had no idea. She made the point that she was embedding Agenda 2060.
I'll quote it. So Jacinda said, and yes, she said, my government is doing something that not many other countries have tried. We have incorporated the principles of the 2030 agenda into our domestic policy making in a way that we hope will drive system level changes. And I believe what we have adopted in New Zealand is needed at a global scale. She was transparent. You've got to hand that to the woman.
Yeah, well, this is it. So she put into our policy, our regulatory and legislative framework, all of the elements of the UN's Agenda 2030 without essentially telling us what she was doing. And of course, one of the elements of that Agenda 2030 is climate change. And in particular, the climate change issue is used to bring about, it's used in an alarmist way to force change onto countries and peoples. In other words, if you scare them enough, then they'll essentially agree to anything. And so that's been the whole thing. I mean, this is what led to New Zealand, you know, Jacinda Ardern declaring a climate emergency. I mean, what a ridiculous thing to do. But anyway, you know, that's what she did. So, and the media, of course, repeat it all and go further on it because they want to print all the alarmist stuff as well. And so you end up with this alarm overplaying everything that happens. And so people, going back to, you know, what we said earlier about, you know, people being a bit afraid to speak out, some of them don't really know whether to be afraid or not. I mean, we've heard of kids at school who say, you know, if they get married, they're never going to have kids because, you know, the world will be fried up by then. And so, you know, it's too dangerous. And then other children who won't eat meat because they think that it's killing the planet. You know, how bad is that, that we actually push this propaganda onto our children in such a way, do this fear-mongering in such a way that we're actually scaring children? And it's just wrong. It is so wrong what's happening in this space.
And scaring is one thing. We are now coercing. We have banks that have jumped onto this bandwagon. We have insurers that have jumped onto this bandwagon. We have this new government carrying on the job of the ex-climate change minister, James Shaw, in carrying on the Coastal Adaptation Act, sort of an exploratory framework. But we do know he's talking of legislation, Minister Simon Watts, by next year coming through, which will, just like we legislated the climate change in 2019, not the natural climate change, but we decided that we are going to put make a law, and regardless of whether or not it's happening, we are doing the same with the coastal adaptation. By next year, I think everyone will know managed retreat is something, and we all just need to do it. We won't be allowed to build in certain places. It's all just coming to, you know, we're reaching the pointy edge here. There's not much further we can go.
Well, that would be such a disaster if they do that. I mean, you know, all based on models that, you know, I think Don said earlier on, you know, they haven't been right ever. Climate models are wrong all the time. They have never, ever been correct. And yet somehow everyone puts their faith in them. It's just madness. The whole thing is so stupid. But what do you do? You know, this is the thing. So what I've decided to do is, I mean, because there's so many things that are wrong, but if you can hit on two things. So one is that, you know, using that 1 meter sea level rise RCP 8.5 measure in policy modelling work, because the UN has said it shouldn't be used in policy work because it's now obsolete, because it's too extreme. So if the UN actually says it shouldn't be used, why on earth are we using it in New Zealand and causing all these problems for local communities? And as you say, in the future, probably going to cause more problems. And the same thing is with the methane measure. If 28 is what they use for all their climate modelling and asserting how much, you know, greenhouse gases New Zealand creates, and therefore how much we have to reduce to get down to the 2050 target, if they're using 28 as the multiplier, that makes the problem a huge amount bigger than it really is. And the UN has said 28 is wrong, it should be 7. And so we want the government to put the right measures in instead of using the incorrect ones. And I think if those climate ministers and prime ministers and other lead ministers got letters from people to say, why don't you correct your mistakes in your modelling and do the right thing for New Zealand, then I think that probably the message will start to sink home with people in positions of power.
Yeah, and I would like to we've been quite harsh on the coalition today, and perhaps cutting them some slack is due, because they are taking a baby step, a small step, with their Climate Change Response Act, I think it's called, and the ag emissions component of that being altered in the statute. So, you know, there's submissions going in, or there's hearings being on that in the next few weeks. But look, you're right, Muriel. It is about making a noise, standing up for your rights, knowing when things are rotten to the core, and actually standing upright with a spine and making a difference for your community, actually. So, you know, we've taken 3/4 of an hour of your time, and look, we're so grateful for it. I just want to implore people to go to the New Zealand Centre for Political Research website and really go through what is just document after document that makes a lot of sense to people like me anyway. And I'd just like to thank you and your team for all the work they do, Muriel. But on top of that, I think your message today is quite clear. Like some of our guests we've had, like Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Centre talks about, it's around local people taking local issues and really driving them hard. And I think it's up to us to take responsibility and bombard our MPs and our local councillors with stuff that we know about, and they clearly don't, or if they do know about it, they're too timid to act upon. So, you know, any final comments from you, Muriel? Because, boy, we've really overused your time.
No, it's just, I think that we underestimate the power of the individual in this country. And it goes back to this thing about, you know, people not engaging in politics too much. But, you know, when you look back, you can remember cases where somebody took a stand on something because it had affected them or their family in some way. And next minute, you know, they've actually managed to make a huge difference, and perhaps they've become a leader in politics or their community or whatever. So I think that we shouldn't ever underestimate our own ability to make a difference. And even if you don't want to make a difference on the big stage, just making a difference in your own family or neighbourhood or whatever, it all helps, right? So what drives all of us is we want to create a better country. We want a better future for our children and our grandchildren. And if we can see something that's in the way, then it is up to us to try and do something about it. And that, I think, is a driving force that everybody can sort of get on board with, if you know what I mean, and do their own bit in their own way. And that really is the message that we all need to remember all the time.
Yep. So look, with that, we, again, Dr. Muriel Newman's our guest today. We thank her for her input. And yeah, please take the messages on board, listeners, because we've got a country to save here, and it needs more than just a few people in the coalition to do the job. So thank you for coming on RCR Greenwashed, Dr. Newman, and we'll talk again soon.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.